Chapter 16. Corruption as a Whole of Society Challenge. By the time their series of conferences reached Johannesburg in 2016, it was apparent to the organizers, CAS and Accountability Now, that further preaching to the converted in government, non-government organizations, academia, the civil society sector, and the judiciary was not going to advance the project aimed at countering the corrupt in an effective and efficient way. The net needed to be spread wider. The guest list of delegates for the Johannesburg conference was very different to those of the previous two conferences. In the concept note preceding the conference, the thinking behind convening it was revealed. A conference on activism against corruption in Africa was called in a bid to chart a course capable of identifying and exchanging best practices and experiences, and ultimately using a practical roadmap toward the successful implementation of the strategies identified. This is a follow-up conference to the one that was held last year, 2015, in Cape Town, on combating corruption in Africa. Undoubtedly, there is a need throughout Africa and the world to generate the necessary political will to deal with corruption effectively and efficiently. All too often, the forms of corruption prevalent in Africa involve the misappropriation of public money. In short, corruption is theft from the poor. The generation of political will to take a serious, principled, and properly resourced stand against corruption involves persuading politicians that it is in their own self-interest to promote measures, structures, and operational environments in which corruption is dealt with appropriately. Among the key practical steps necessary to achieve the aforementioned desire involves mobilizing the masses from the grassroots level through educational and advocacy work by the civil society, commerce, industry, faith-based organizations, and political parties, whether or not they are in government, in order to give impetus to the striving for governance informed by integrity. Use of the media to give focus to the longing of ordinary people for government with integrity that is aimed at serving their needs rather than enriching their representatives is indicated. The objective of the conference is to move masses from being merely anti-corrupt. Everyone is at least nominally against corruption, whether by way of lip service or by way of genuine concern, to concentrating activism on a country-by-country basis in a way that focuses on what is needed on the ground in each country. The conference will draw on the experience of the delegates, the expertise of speakers, and the energy generated in the crucible of debate to devise a resolution that is capable of taking the war on the corrupt forward to victory. Some of the delegates and speakers were unlikely participants in a conference with a corruption-related theme. The critical role of the media, especially as regards investigative journalism, was tackled from three different perspectives. Mr. Bogard Tromp, deputy and acting editor of the Mail and Guardian newspaper, gave the media practitioner's perspective. Professor Franz Kruger of the University of Witwatersrand contributed the media scholar's perspective. Mr. Henry Miner, executive director, Article 19, East African region, provided insights into the media defender's perspective. In a separate session, Professor Jamal Mujuzi of the University of Western Cape, whose area of expertise is in international cooperation in criminal matters, spoke to the role of civil society in countering corruption. Professor Reverend Aidan Masafiri, a research associate from the Mgwengwe Catholic University, Moshi, Tanzania, provided enlightenment on the role of the faith-based organizations. Mr. Mandala Mambulasa, attorney and former president of the Malawi Bar Association, spoke about the role of the private sector in the fight against corruption. The role of the trade unions was described by Mr. Zwelinzima Vavi, former General Secretary of the Congress of South African Trade Unions and Vice Chairperson of the Millennium Labour Council. The United Nations has identified the need to tackle grand corruption because it poses an obstacle to the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals, which it wishes to achieve by 2030. One of these SDGs is the establishment of strong governance institutions. The absence of strong anti-corruption machinery of state in many nations is at the core of the culture of impunity which the corrupt in high places enjoy. The UN General Assembly has resolved to hold a special session on corruption in June 2021. Colombia intends to propose at that special sitting, called Special Session of the United Nations General Assembly, or UNGAS 2021, that an international anti-corruption court be established to take on issues around grand corruption, kleptocracy, and state capture. As the UN session is scheduled for 3 days, it is likely that a wide-ranging debate will be held. A panel to look at the issues of financial accountability, transparency, and integrity, commonly called the FACTI panel, has been established in preparation for the special sitting and will report by February 2021. Its interim report was published in September 2020 and has been noted in a previous chapter of this book. Obviously, financial accountability and transparency are beyond the scope of this book, save as they impact on corruption. However, the integrity aspect of the panel's work will have to involve a worldwide reconsideration of the strength of the anti-corruption machinery available at present, in particular in relation to its ability to deal with issues of grand corruption. On the 2nd of March 2020, the FACTI panel was launched with terms of reference that would have had Moses in a sweat as he answered God's call to summit Mount Sinai. As corruption was infecting his nation, and had been since Eve tempted Adam in the Garden of Eden, those of the Abrahamic traditions will know that the panel faces a daunting task. The two initiators of the panel, the President of the General Assembly and the President of the Economic and Social Council, provide an overview of their vision in the announcement of the establishment of the FACTI panel. This initiative, taken upon our own responsibility, was developed in consideration of the request contained in the General Assembly Resolution 74/206 entitled Promotion of International Cooperation to Combat Illicit Financial Flows and Strengthen Good Practices on Assets Return to Foster Sustainable Development. We expect the panel to offer new and creative solutions to make the systems for financial accountability, transparency, and integrity more robust, effective, and universal in approach. This book focuses, among other things, on the unavoidable role of countering corruption in the execution of the mission of the panel as it relates to reforming integrity systems with new and creative solutions. Accountability and integrity are currently in short supply in the world, hence the establishment of the panel. Corruption in high places, sometimes called grand corruption, a concept yet to be defined in international law, is often identified as the reason for the absence of proper accountability and effective integrity in the modern context. When it comes to grand corruption, the problem is arguably somewhat more subtle. It is the culture of corruption with impunity that emboldens ever-increasing numbers of powerfully placed individuals to go over to the dark side, to enjoy the fruits of their illegal activities. Looting without any prospect of being punished, or even having the loot confiscated, wherever in the world it is stashed, are attractive propositions to too many politicians, public servants, and people in business. Impunity lures them in with its siren call. That was not the case with Adam and Eve. He was told off in no uncertain terms. On your account, the earth will be cursed. Eve's punishment was great labor in childbearing. The middleman, the serpent, was told, on your belly you will crawl, and dust you will eat. Modern kleptocrats have devised the perverse aspects of a world order in which they have been able to avoid appropriately dire consequences for corrupt activities. These abominations include captured or meek law enforcement officials, corrupt judges, and multiple opportunities for repurposing the state to their own greedy ends. Dense tax laws, which elide the avoidance, which is legal, and evasion, which is illegal, of taxes. Tax havens, illicit financial flows to tax havens, secrecy, a la the Panama Papers, and the exploitation of resources of the developing nations that serve to enrich developed nations unfairly, are further examples of the world order currently in place. It is upon this culture of impunity that the panel is going to have to focus some attention if its terms of reference are to produce autonomously devised, lasting solutions to the perennial problems that grand corruption inflicts on nations, and especially the poor, from whose needs resources are diverted to the corrupt to fritter away. The terms of reference of the panel are wide-ranging. A sample relevant to corruption or the absence of integrity will suffice to illustrate this point. The current international institutional architecture falls short on many accounts in combating all types of illicit finance, from criminal, corrupt, or commercial activities, and returning stolen assets to their country of origin. These areas include financial transparency, tax matters, combating bribery and corruption, preventing money laundering, and returning stolen assets. Rethinking and redesigning the international frameworks related to financial accountability, transparency, and integrity is critical to finance the Sustainable Development Goals. This is a global problem that requires global cooperation. The stakes are high, and the panel is expected to contribute to the implementation of the ambitious and transformational vision of the 2030 Agenda to change global economic and financial systems to make them fair and equitable, systems that contribute to ending poverty and hunger and achieving sustainable development in all its dimensions. Our common goal is to promote peaceful and inclusive societies for sustainable development, provide access to justice for all, and build effective, accountable, and inclusive institutions. A leading cause of the global problem alluded to in the terms of reference quoted above is the impunity that the powerful are able to enjoy. There is no shortage of laws relating to corruption. As was pointed out by Judges Goldstone and Wolfe of Integrity Initiatives International in their Boston Globe article of March 2020, grand corruption does not flourish because of a lack of laws. There are 187 nations party to the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. Almost all of them have laws prohibiting extortion, bribery, money laundering, and misappropriation of national resources. They also have an international obligation to enforce those laws against their corrupt leaders. However, kleptocrats enjoy impunity in their own countries because they control the administration of justice. They will not permit the prosecution and punishment of their collaborators and themselves. Irrespective of what the FACTI panel recommends in relation to financial accountability and transparency, all of its work will come to naught if it is unable to devise a means of ensuring integrity by dealing decisively with the kleptocrats who regard themselves as above the law and who continue to loot and plunder the public purse to the detriment of the UN SDGs. It is the achievement of these goals which has inspired the FACTI initiative. Close attention to what is technically feasible and politically viable is required. Devising a means of seeing off the kleptocrats will involve innovative initiatives. According to Article 5 of UNCAC, its 187 member nations are obliged to maintain effective, coordinated anti-corruption policies that promote the participation of society and reflect the principles of the rule of law, proper management of public affairs and public property, integrity, transparency, and accountability. These obligations are all too often honored in the breach, in that no effective anti-corruption structures operate to ensure integrity, hence the culture of corruption with impunity. The FACTI panel will have to give close attention to this aspect of its terms of reference. Any failure to do so will surely render other reforms it recommends difficult to enforce or even unachievable. Either the anti-corruption machinery of the nations which are party to the UN Convention Against Corruption might have to undergo radical reform to beef up the effectiveness of the war on grand corruption, or some other way of dealing with the kleptocrats is going to have to be devised. A cost-benefit analysis may reveal that transferring responsibility for ending the culture of grand corruption with impunity to an international anti-corruption court, which operates on the basis of complementarity, may prove to be the most elegant solution to the problem. Complementarity means that this new court would exercise its authority to prosecute only if a country was found to be unable or unwilling to prosecute its leaders itself. Countries not desirous of having their leaders internationally prosecuted would accordingly be incentivized to improve the anti-corruption and integrity measures on the home front. It is going to be interesting to see what the FACTI panel brings down from the mountain when it reports back to the two presidents who have established it, especially on how to effectively defend the integrity systems currently under siege in world affairs. An interesting feature of its work is the decision to hold town hall meetings for the panel via cyberspace. At these meetings, anyone who cares to attend is given the opportunity of participating. This globalizes the efforts of the panel and provides fertile grounds for the exchange of ideas. In the run-up to the UNGAS 2021, an invitation to present submissions for consideration has attracted some valuable input from civil society. A thoughtful and rich submission by Transparency International on the 20th of March 2020, includes the following overview of possibilities as regards international infrastructure. It is headed New International Infrastructure, Options for Tackling Grand Corruption Impunity. The nature and scale of the problem of grand corruption suggests the need for a comprehensive approach that includes reforms to international justice institutions. One notable proposal from the government of Colombia and U.S. Judge Mark Wolf is for creation of an international anti-corruption court with jurisdiction over grand corruption cases where countries themselves are unable or unwilling to pursue them. The proposal for a standalone court deserves careful study, so too do six other potential reforms to the international criminal law infrastructure. 1. Extending the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. 2. Regional anti-corruption courts similar to regional human rights courts that already exist. This is under consideration in Africa under the Malabo Protocol and in discussions at the Economic Community of West African States, called ECOWAS. 3. International or regional anti-corruption prosecutors or enforcement agencies. The new European Prosecutor's Office provides an example of how that might work. 4. International or regional investigative agencies. An example of this is the International Anti-Corruption Coordination Centre established by the United Kingdom in July 2017, which brings together specialist law enforcement officers from multiple agencies around the world to tackle allegations of grand corruption. And 5, a framework for ad hoc international prosecution or investigative functions focused on one country. A salient example is the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, set up by the United Nations in 2006. Its mandate ended in 2019. The complexity of this subject matter points to the need for in-depth analysis and multi-stakeholder expert discussions over an extended period. The options and possible combinations of options should be evaluated according to a range of criteria, including political feasibility, effectiveness, and cost, criteria that are, to some extent, interconnected. Along the same lines, the statement adopted by the Oslo Expert Group meeting in June 2019 includes two of its recommendations encouraging the exploration of innovative ideas, including most of the infrastructure options mentioned above. The Basel Institute has innovative ideas around the recovery of the loot of grand corruption. Member states should, through the political statement, be urged to implement the following measures. 1. Member states shall introduce non-conviction-based confiscation measures in order to provide for judicial proceedings for the confiscation of property that has been acquired through or that is related to the commission of an offence established in the convention. 2. Member states shall adopt such measures as may be necessary to permit their competent authorities to provide assistance in obtaining evidence and to provide assistance in freezing or seizing assets in relation to non-conviction-based investigations and proceedings in another state party and to give effect to an order in such proceedings issued by a court or other competent authority of another state party. 3. Member states shall adopt such measures as may be necessary to allow confiscation of assets subject to the power of disposal of a public official if the wealth of the person has increased disproportionately during his or her public function and it has not been demonstrated that the asset in question was acquired legitimately. 4. Member states shall interpret the principle of dual criminality in line with Article 43(2) of the Convention. 5. Member states shall take such measures as may be necessary to permit their competent authorities to provide information and evidence to another state party without prior notification to the affected person, if the requesting country demonstrates that such is necessary in light of the nature of the conduct under investigation. And 6, member states shall take such measures as may be necessary to to recognize damage to another state party as a basis for returning confiscated assets or monies refunded as the disgorgement of profits. The Open Contracting Partnership has summarized its submissions for consideration at UNGAS 2021. It says, governments spend over $9.5 trillion on public contracting and procurement every year, a third of all government spending. It is a government's number one corruption risk, so it is always an important anti-corruption topic. New approaches, including open data, digitization, and civic monitoring, mounting evidence of their impact and their widespread endorsement, are transforming international best practices. This makes the UNGAS on corruption an important opportunity to codify and share these new emerging norms. The UNCAC coalition stresses selected topics, most fundamental of which is the need for effective and strong institutions. It discusses effective institutions in the following terms. Member states should commit to ensuring that anti-corruption bodies, those mandated to work on the prevention of corruption, as well as those specialized in investigating and combating corruption, are provided with the necessary independence, powers, and resources to carry out their functions effectively and can cooperate free from any undue influence. UNCAC Article 6 and Article 36, including by ensuring that the principles of the Jakarta Statement are fully implemented and complied with, both in law and in practice. More broadly, in line with SDG number 16.6, which is develop effective, accountable, and transparent institutions at all levels, member states should take steps to strengthen institutions that play a crucial role in national integrity systems, such as election commissions, regulatory and oversight bodies, law enforcement agencies, and the judiciary, as well as the oversight role of parliaments. Captured dysfunctional and ineffective oversight bodies and institutions in many countries are at the center of weak oversight systems and poor performance in preventing and fighting corruption. Other less relevant but nevertheless important topics raised in the UNCAC coalition submission include the regulation of access to information, better architecture for public procurement, and the observance of transparency in relation to public finances, transparent and accessible company registries, beneficial ownership transparency, regulation of political funding, management of conflict of interest and asset disclosure. On the management of conflict of interest, the coalition suggests that to ensure a clear separation of public position and private interests, and to prevent and manage conflicts of interest, UNCAC Articles 7.4, 8, and 12.2e, member states should adopt, implement, and enforce adequate and comprehensive frameworks to address conflicts of interest for decision makers in the public sector. Such frameworks should also regulate cases of the revolving door, the movement of individuals between public office and private sector jobs in the same area in either direction. The United Nations Convention Against Corruption Coalition submission relating to the role of civil society and its participation in anti-corruption efforts is a fitting way to end any discussion of this topic. Member states should use the UNGAS for a high-level political commitment, highlighting the importance of involving civil society organizations, academia, and other non-government stakeholders in anti-corruption efforts. Furthermore, The political declaration should include a clear commitment to creating and maintaining a safe and enabling environment for civil society, to eliminate any impediments in law and practice that constrain such participation contrary to the letter and the spirit of the Convention. International human rights standards and the 2030 UN Agenda for Sustainable Development. This requires appropriate measures for respecting, promoting, and protecting the freedom to seek, receive, publish, and disseminate information concerning corruption, and the ability for civil society organizations and the media to organize and operate independently and without fear of reprisal because of their anti-corruption work. Quite so. Konrad Adenauer himself formed the Christian Democratic Union as a political party to unite Catholics and Protestants in Germany in their opposition to the scourge of national socialism of the kind Hitler introduced in the early part of the 20th century. Cass, as bearer of his legacy, maintains the Christian ethos which prompted Adenauer's role in the creation of a constitutional order in which the rule of law plays a leading role. The patron of accountability now is Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu. His activism against apartheid and fealty to peace and justice at a time when it was difficult for him to champion his cause make him the ideal patron and one whom accountability now counts itself fortunate to have. In these circumstances, it is appropriate that the role of the faith-based institutions in countering corruption should feature in the work of the conferences discussed in this book. The Abrahamic tradition, which has given birth to the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic faiths, is one in which corruption has featured since time immemorial. After the creation, the first story in the Old Testament is that of Adam and Eve's fall from grace in the Garden of Eden, while the story of Christ's betrayal for a bribe of 30 pieces of silver is central to the New Testament. Other Bible passages relevant to the topic of corruption are numerous. The Holy Quran is also peppered with references that are the subject matter of a separate endnote to this book. As religious thought is focused on achieving the triumph of good over evil, it makes good sense that faith-based institutions should be involved in the struggle to rid the world of corruption in all its manifestations. The influence of the guiding principles of all faiths is both welcome and benign. There is, however, a need for the clergy to become more directly involved in countering corruption through advocacy of reforms where they are needed and the promotion of integrity in the affairs of the state and of faith-based organizations too. Investigative journalism. The specialized journalists who dig dirt on the corrupt have an important role to play. Their efforts bring to the attention of the public the malfeasance of the powerful and those involved in petty corruption too. The Nixon presidency in the USA ended in disgrace due to the unflagging efforts of two journalists who broke the Watergate burglary story. John Profumo resigned from the British cabinet after the press got hold of the details of his dalliance with Christine Keeler, who was involved with a Russian spy. The role of investigative journalists is akin to the proverbial canary in the coal mine, used to warn miners of toxic fumes at or near the coalface. It is often a dangerous role and requires great skill and tenacity to achieve success. The protection of sources, the courting of whistleblowers, and the fending off of police officials more interested in finding out where the leak came from than investigating the corruption revealed are all professional hazards which the intrepid journalists have to face to achieve success in their work. Sifting of documentary evidence in order to find the diamonds in the dust often purposely buried and concealed, is an arduous task that tests the tenacity of investigative journalists. They put their lives in danger by doing their work properly. Society as a whole is in their debt. The perspective of the leading investigative journalists who work for a Daily Maverick in South Africa is instructive. They say, "It is important at this point to pull back and understand where South Africa is right now. The twin scourges of horrific violence against women and xenophobia have again reared their ugly heads in September 2019. The country is a stuttering ship about to hit an iceberg. We are still nursing the wounds after the mauling that was Jacob Zuma's presidency. These wounds are deep and by now badly infected. It is not at all certain that the patient, South Africa, can recover. Any moment now, it could slip into anaphylactic shock, and the entire structure, whose foundation was so expertly eroded over the last decade, may collapse. The economy is in free fall. People are desperately unhappy. The reforms that were expected to happen have yet to materialize, in great part thanks to the vicious fight back that has been led by the Zuma-aligned forces. One can't really expect them to ride quietly into the sunset should they lose this battle. It would be orange overalls instead of Armani suits and red berets. The streets are angry. The streets are dangerous. It is time for decisive action by the South African state and its government. It is time for it to either put up or shut up. For way too long, it was parts of civil society, the judiciary and the media, who were not only doing their job but also covering for a historically almost comically absent state and its organs. It was the media who brought into the public domain the truth about the true extent of state capture, corruption. It was civil society when it was not feeding the hungry, clothing and healing the poor, and educating the insufficiently educated, all of which should be the government's domain, that took the media exposés and doggedly pursued them all the way to the Constitutional Court. All along, the judges refused to be intimidated and passed the judgments which in any normal country would have changed history. But we, the media, cannot do it in a vacuum anymore. Independent media these days is an impecunious place to be, where journalists are barely surviving, working for publications that soon might be no more. NGOs are so stretched that they may soon break, and that's even before they have to endure the ignominy of being branded foreign agents by the state capture players and their attack dogs. So, here we are. It is time for all, especially the bodies comprising the security cluster, to act. It is time for the NPA to take a trip to the nearest court with a bunch of empty folders. All they need is to print the media's exposés and the accompanying attachments in the print shop across the street from the court. It is time for all ministers and everyone else paid by a public dime to show up for the work and take action. Of course, results can't be achieved in a day, as the problems are so deep and extensive that anyone can understand that it will take time to fix them, but they need to be seen as acting in people's interest and not for their narrow, short-term political gain. It is also time for the parts of the opposition that are willing to participate in rebuilding this country to actually do it. Time to stop shouting at people. Elections are in the future. Now, we all need to ensure that we actually have that future. And it is time for President Ramaphosa to remember he is not only elected to be the head of the South African government, but also to be the leader of the South African people. That requires compassion, action, and true commitment. Whatever the state capture actors might do to taint his past, The people of South Africa will support him if they see that he is fighting for their present and never stops working for their future. The independent journalists of this country are tired of shouldering that future, sometimes on their own. Over many years, we uncovered what really happened in Marikana. We exposed the Guptas, Nkandla, and the depths of state capture. Since the Gupta leaks, literally hundreds of people involved in state capture crimes have been outed, fully exposing the Secretary General of the ruling party and the top leadership of the third biggest party in the country. How many of them have been arrested, charged, and jailed since, say, Marikana's police massacred the striking miners in 2012? How many? And you still expect us to consider South Africa a respectable state? Relying on the media and civil society to do all these important jobs of government is unsustainable. The media fraternity cannot keep its motivation forever, or our jobs, or our lives. Do not think that investigations like VBS theft, money laundering, and life's little luxuries, Julius Malema's time of spending dangerously, will continue to materialize from thin air over and over again. Journalists in South Africa operate in clear and present danger. It is time to do something about it. A good place to start would be to take the investigations brought into the public domain by Scorpio, Amabungani, News24, and other investigative outfits seriously. The future of our country now depends on you doing your job. Should you do nothing, just please don't say again that we did not warn you. Because we have. Because we are warning you right now. Your move, South Africa. Within 2 days of publishing this editorial, Julius Malema banned Daily Maverick, Scorpio, and Amabungani from attending any further EFF events or press conferences. Beyond the concerning implications for press freedom, the staff at Daily Maverick were largely unperturbed. The basis of their investigations comes not from EFF press conferences, but rather what happens when the cameras stop rolling. Civil society organizations. The role of civil society organizations, the foundations, institutions, NGOs, and more informal groupings and alliances, is mentioned in the Daily Maverick editorial quoted immediately above. The lot of CSOs is varied and dependent upon the levels of funding that they are able to garner. CSOs that stand up against oppressive and corrupt regimes find themselves accused of being unpatriotic and sometimes also of being recipients of foreign funding and of pursuing hidden agendas of treasonous and seditious nature at the behest of their paymaster. Some in the sector find their hands tied by timid funders who hesitate until it is too late to fund controversial projects which speak truth to power. It is as well for those in civil society to remember that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. Active citizenship is needed rather than being passive subjects of authoritarian regimes that are strangers to the rule of law and kleptocratic by inclination. Trade unions. We have offered an alternative definition of corruption as theft from the poor. Members of trade unions are generally working class, although that is not always so. Nevertheless, it is not the workers who have the opportunities to ransack funds for corrupt purposes. The strength of trade unions is that clear lines of responsibility exist to exact accountability from employers, members, and union officials. This structure provides the opportunity for installing integrity systems in the workplace so as to prevent the leakage of funds to the detriment of the members of the unions active in the workplace. It is because union organizers are alert to the rights of their members and willing to assert them against corrupt practices that undermine members' interests that unions are well placed, when properly organized, to counter corruption in their sphere of influence. It does happen that unions can lose their way. Zweli Vavi, former General Secretary of COSATU, a confederation of unions that is in alliance with the ANC in South Africa, had delegates to the Johannesburg Conference spellbound when he related events at the Polokwane Conference of the ANC held in 2007, at which Jacob Zuma ascended to the leadership of the ANC. At the time, Vavi, a staunch Zuma supporter, hailed his success as the Zuma tsunami. By the time he attended the conference at which he spoke to the invitees of CAS and Accountability Now, Vavi had changed his views in the face of a mountain of evidence of the corruption and state capture in which Zuma was a leading participant. Vavi called the election of Zuma the greatest mistake in the history of the world. This is an overstatement, of course, but it does reflect the depth of feeling of a man who was tricked by the deceit of Zuma into giving him political support that prevented Zuma from standing trial and enabled him to be elected as president of South Africa after the ANC won the elections that were held in 2009. Unions in South Africa are now more cautious about whom they support in the political field.